From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Every day brings more alarm about the rise of COVID-19 cases in the U.S., especially where people are refusing vaccinations. And we're hearing from more and more very ill patients who wish they'd taken them. CNN's Randy Kaye met many at Jacksonville Baptist Medical Center in Florida, patients like this very sick woman.
Yeah, I cannot breathe good. I have shortness of breath. I feel sorry about not getting a vaccine.
You're sorry you didn't get the vaccine. Do you think you would be here if you had gotten the vaccine?
No.
Former CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden is here. He's now CEO of the Global Heart Disease Prevention Group Resolve to Save Lives. Dr. Frieden, we know the Delta variant is more infectious, but we just heard that woman. And Apurva Mandavilla writes in the New York Times that if more people were vaccinated, there would be no resurgence of any variant, Delta or otherwise. Your thoughts?
What we know about Delta is that it's remarkably infectious. It's about twice as infectious as the COVID we've been dealing with for the past nearly year and a half. And what that means, unfortunately, is that even with half of people in this country vaccinated, we're going to have a similar explosive spread if we don't change our behavior. What's so painful to me to watch about this as a physician is that we have the tools to stop COVID, particularly vaccinations and masks indoors. And in far too many communities, we're not using those tools.
Yeah, well, she is making the case that it's because of the unvaccinated, not the Delta, that we're having this surge, that any variant would just be inflamed the way it is right now in the U.S. because of the people who are unvaccinated. Do you think it's time to, instead of enticing people to get vaccines with rewards, start punishing again? You cannot do this, you cannot do that if you're not vaccinated.
It's a delicate balance because in some ways, the more you push, the more resistance you'll get. Sadly, more people will be willing to get vaccinated because they see the devastation that COVID is causing. I think what we also have to really be clear about is that although you will see some breakthrough infections, getting vaccinated reduces your risk of dying by at least 100 times. So it is true that if we didn't have such a low rate of vaccination in so many places, we would not have anything like the devastating outbreak that, unfortunately, we're likely to have in the coming weeks.
Yeah. Could you explain why is it that unvaccinated people lead to, you know, a more vicious virus and, you know, maybe even more variants? What's the correlation?
The more uncontrolled spread of this virus there is, the more chance it has to mutate and then have mutations that are more infectious or maybe even more deadly or maybe even better at sneaking around our immune defenses will evolve and spread. So uncontrolled spread anywhere in the world is a potential threat anywhere else in the world. That's why it's in all of our best interest to increase vaccinations so we can tamp down spread of the virus. This virus is a very difficult virus to fight, but we do have the tools that can do it.
Well, Dr. Frieden, we know the vaccines work incredibly well. We know breakthroughs are rare. Serious illness while vaccinated, also very, very rare. But I heard a man who'd been in the Provincetown, Massachusetts outbreak say he was double vaccinated, and he got violently ill for 2 days. Now, we know many gay men were in that outbreak in that popular vacation spot. Many may be living successfully with HIV. Does another virus like HIV make you more vulnerable to a breakthrough?
People are wondering about HIV. The broader issue is, what are the different types of immunocompromised? Because there are a lot of people out there who are on 10 million, roughly, who are either immunocompromised in some way, HIV or another disease, or who are on medications that weaken the immune system. For immunocompromised, it's a very broad range of conditions. It's everything from a lot of immunosuppressive medication for people who have an organ transplant to people who are on a medication for arthritis that may make them more susceptible to infection or to severe infection. We don't yet know enough about the risk factors for breakthrough infections. I expect that we'll learn more about that in the coming weeks. But if I had to guess, I'd say advanced age, people 85 and over, no magic cut point of age, may be a risk factor for not being as fully protected by two doses. And one of the things that I hope we'll learn more about in the coming days and weeks is who is getting severe breakthrough infections, and are there some people who would benefit from a third dose of the vaccine? That's not a booster dose. A booster dose might be 6 or 12 months in, or 5 years or 10 years in. That's certain people who don't respond as robustly. But Robin, the bottom line is, with cases doubling and doubling again, breakthrough infections will double and double again, and some of those will be very severe. But for the vast majority of people who are fully vaccinated, they're well protected. This is a remarkably effective vaccine.
Dr. Tom Frieden, former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, now CEO of the group Resolve to Save Lives. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
And today we've heard emotional testimony from the Capitol police officers who defended the Capitol as a pro-Trump mob attempted to stage an insurrection on January 6th. Officer Michael Fanone had this to say to lawmakers that he protected that day.
I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
So how did this investigation become so politicized, and what does this moment say about our democracy? For more, we're joined by Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We heard a lot of very striking testimony from these officers. We saw at least a couple lawmakers break down into tears. Historically speaking, what parts of this are unprecedented?
Well, what's unprecedented is to hear them basically telling the country to believe what actually happened, to believe what people saw before their eyes. I mean, some of the testimony is about the traumatic events that unfolded, and some, as you just played in the clip, is pleading with Congress and the country not to allow people to spin this entire insurrection, mob violence, in a way that doesn't accord with the facts that they lived.
Only two Republicans were on this committee. They are the ones who voted for the formation of the committee, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, and Republicans asked for a boycott last week. In terms of congressional history, at least, how are we to understand this politicization of an attack on the Capitol? Has there been other times in our history when the institutions, the basic institutions of the country, were attacked and Congress was not united?
No. I mean, there's been moments when the Capitol, unfortunately, was attacked, when the British torched the Capitol in 1814. There was a terrorist attack in 1954, and other incidents like this. But they always brought some degree of unity, even if the parties were very far apart on key issues. These are the kind of basic moments where both parties want to understand what has happened. And here what you're seeing is Republicans, who in this case are implicated in the attack, which makes it quite different, are basically, other than those two members of Congress, stonewalling, and now going beyond stonewalling, reinventing what actually happened on January 6th.
So Adam Kinzinger, again, Republican of Illinois, said something that struck me. He said there's a difference between breaking the law and rejecting the rule of law. Obviously, we think of the Supreme Court as being all about the law, but to a certain extent, that's also Congress's job as well. So what does this say when we can't sort of agree on what it means, or whether someone has broken the law or not?
Well, then you have total dysfunction. It's a little bit like discussions we've had over what happens when parties don't agree on the basic facts in front of them. And if there is no rule of law guiding how legislators handle this particular problem, we're in a free-for-all. And I think that's why at least these two Republicans have been so shaken by the position that their party has taken on this.
And we also, I mean, we talked about what's historically unprecedented, but we've also heard people say they fear this will become a precedent, that in every 4 years we may see the same kind of refusal to accept election results. Is that something that concerns you?
It does, and let's hope that's not the case. But I think that was part of the big risk that took place when the former president, Trump, actually amplified this kind of argument and took arguments that have often been in the realm of extremists and conspiracy theorists and made it mainstream. The violence was a culmination of that month-long argument, and I suspect that might not go away. We might see more of this, hopefully not, but now there is a strong precedent, you know, come next election for this kind of rejection of the outcome.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
A big disappointment in Tokyo today. Simone Biles, the powerhouse on the USA women's gymnastics team, pulled out of the team final competition. The women's team settled for a silver medal. Russia took gold. For more on what happened, we're joined by NPR correspondent Leila Fadel, who's in Tokyo. Leila, I think it's fair to say that people expected Simone Biles to dominate the gymnastics competition, not just in individual, but on that team competition. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, she was heavily favored to rake in Olympic gold medals, and then she pulled out during the competition. It was just this absolute shock, the leader of this team suddenly gone. And she said later in a press conference that she wasn't physically injured. This was about her mental health. She was stressed. It was an incredible amount of pressure. I mean, she is the greatest gymnast in the world, expected to outperform her competitors. And that's not an easy burden to carry, and she's done it for the last 5 years. Today, she said she just wasn't there mentally. She made the decision to pull out after her first rotation on the vault. She was going for a 2.5 twist, and then midair, she said she just got lost. It did 1.5 instead. She didn't pull in the point she expected, walked back to her team, and she told her coach that she thought the rest of the team needed to compete without her. They reassured her, "I promise you're fine," and she told them no. She was calling it, and she cheered her team on from the sidelines.
The USA Gymnastics team issued a statement that she's withdrawn because of a medical issue. She said in a press conference that she needs to focus on her mental health. Let's take a listen.
Right. It's been a long week. It's been a long Olympic process. It's been a long year. And I think we're just a little bit too stressed out. But we should be out here having fun. And sometimes that's not the case.
What else, Leila, did we hear from either her or the team?
Yeah, I mean, she hinted at this earlier on Instagram this week. She wrote about feeling the weight of the world on her shoulders, adding that the pressures may seem like they don't get to her, but it's hard. And despite all of the superhuman things she can do as a gymnast, she's human. She expanded on that during the press conference, speaking about the stress and the pressure of these Olympics in this last year. And we saw her teammates rally around her, praise her for her strength, dedicating the silver medal to Biles. And Biles had a message for other athletes: put their mental health first, because if they don't, then they're not going to enjoy the sport, and they're not going to succeed as much as they want to. The U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee CEO Sarah Hirschlin later said she was proud of Simone Biles for who she is as a person, teammate, and athlete, and applauded her for prioritizing her mental health and offering her full support of the team.
And she was out there cheering on the team. Is she now out of the Olympics completely? Could she compete as an individual?
That's really unclear at this point. She said she was going to take it day by day in that press conference. Tomorrow they get the morning off, and she said that would be some good mental rest. And so at this point, I think she's still figuring it out. The next time she would compete, if she decides she's ready, is Thursday in the all-around individual competition. And I have to say, it was incredible to watch these young women come to this presser so poised, so cohesive, and so supportive of each other. Biles praised her fellow teammates for stepping in when she was down. "Kudos to you," she told them, and they responded, "No, kudos to you."
So we only have about 30 seconds here, Leila, but how did her exit from the team competition affect the team's performance?
Ultimately, it was no one thing that put them in second. Russia was just really good and executed seamless and difficult routines.
We'll continue to follow the story. Leila Fadel is an NPR correspondent covering the Olympics in Tokyo. Leila, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The word exotic is often used to describe, say, animals, places, women, perhaps most commonly, though, food. And our next guest says that word is problematic no matter what it's describing, and we should stop using it, full stop. That's because what's exotic to you might not be exotic to your neighbor, And let's be honest, have you ever heard that word used to describe something that's white? Washington Post food writer Daniela Galarza parses all of this in her recent story, Stop Calling Food Exotic, and she joins me now. Welcome to Hearing Now.
Thanks so much for having me, Celeste.
So this conversation came up as part of your job where you create recipes for the Post. And I understand that you, I guess, not just one recipe, but a few recipes, you got responses from people saying these spices or these ingredients are too exotic, right? Why did that bother you?
Yeah, you know, I think first on just a practical level, I wasn't sure what they meant. The definition of the word changes so much based on your perspective. And I think that makes it problematic when I'm trying to troubleshoot things for readers. I want to use language that's as clear as possible. And I'd hope they'd want to too. So I had some great exchanges with them just to understand what they meant by that.
The exotic has actually sort of been set aside by a number of people or pointed to as an example of a word one shouldn't use when referencing people. The argument always is that, look, this is what we call pets or animals at a wild animal park, and not to use it to refer to people. Why do you think we should also not use it for food?
I think anytime you use it, you're really centering a white dominant perspective, and particularly one that's maybe Anglo-American. And the reason I say that has to do with the history of the word, its origins, and even its definition and usage today. So it came about, it's originally a Greek word. It originally meant something that was foreign or alien. And it was likely invented by the Greeks as a way to describe the people that they were conquering, that they were subjugating in their, you know, years and centuries of conquering. And so that usage actually was pretty low. And if you look at the word's usage over time through history, it increased tremendously during British imperialism and colonialism, and then has increased even more today. And I have sort of another pet theory about why that is. But in any of these cases, it's always been used to describe people as a way of othering them and diminishing them, separating them from what we might consider the norm. And I find that really problematic, especially in today's society, which I feel is very global and international and sort of naturally open.
I mean, obviously, I have to ask you about your pet theory on why it's persistent.
So I talked to a number of sociologists about the use of the word, and I also did a lot of research in trying to figure out if there were other languages. Obviously, the word has been translated from the Greek to English, French, and Spanish and Italian, and it's been translated into other languages for which there is no similar word. You know, I was really looking to see, is it possible that, let's say, someone from Argentina had developed a completely different word using indigenous roots to describe someone from, let's say, the African continent. And I think, you know, there just wasn't anything like that. It really has this history of imperialism, of sort of like domination over the other, that I think is incredibly problematic, especially today. But I think the reason there's an increase in its usage is a desire to go back to a time in which there was a really easy distinction between one group of people and another, and having a hierarchy between them.
Which is related to, I mean, one of the things that you point out is that some foods don't get labeled as exotic.
Exactly.
Yeah, that there's certain parts of the world where their food is just labeled as Central American food or South American food, as opposed to exotic ingredients from Thailand. So I see echoes in this discussion you're having with what we're seeing in grocery stores, for example. Growing up, we had ethnic food aisles. They eventually became international food aisles. And now those are kind of disappearing because people are saying, why are you separating these out from all the rest of the food? And that seems related to this conversation about the use of the word exotic. Do you see this as a sort of awakening among people in the industry, the dining and food industry, about their use of language?
I do, absolutely. I think it echoes a lot of the arguments that have made about the use of the word ethnic. And I think it forces us to think about how we categorize people and the food that they eat. And by exoticizing it, we're separating them out from a dominant culture that I don't think increasingly is going to continue to exist. I think we're moving towards a truly an international, a global world in which distinctions between people will be much less important.
So if I am making a recipe and all of a sudden I come across something that I don't have in my grocery store, shirataki noodles or something, if I am not supposed to use the word exotic for an ingredient that I don't recognize or have never tasted, how should I describe it?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think it's worth sort of reframing how we approach things. First, I want to say I'm sure at some point in my life I used the word exotic, and maybe only in the last 10 years did I start thinking about why and what it meant when I used it, what it meant to other people and sort of the legacy of it. But if I'm looking at a recipe and I see an ingredient that's not familiar to me, I know that a definition for it is just a Google search away. I also know that I can probably find some information about where to find it online, if not order it online. And so it might be seen, depending on where you live in the world and in the United States, it might be a rare ingredient. It might be harder to find. So I think about those, using those terms to describe it, because those are just factual sort of logistics issues. But I wouldn't otherize it in any way.
Washington Post food writer Daniela Galarza talking about her recent story, Stop Calling Food Exotic. Daniela, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Celeste. I appreciate it.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
After President Biden met with the Iraq Prime Minister yesterday, the Biden administration announced that by the end of the year, the U.S. will no longer be engaged in a combat mission in Iraq. Now, this might sound like the American troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, but U.S. officials are saying that in Iraq, most of the 2,500 troops stationed there will stay. For more, let's bring in NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. And Michelle, I can hear people say, wait, a withdrawal, but you're not leaving. So remind us, what's the current mission in Iraq and what does this move mean?
Right. So, Robin, you know, they were sent there by the Obama administration to fight ISIS. Biden administration officials say they've made a lot of progress in that fight, though they're not ready to announce mission accomplished. So they say they're still training Iraqi troops, assisting them when needed. That's part of the mission will continue, Biden says. But by the end of the year, as you said, they're going to have this purely advisory role. Administration officials call it a significant change in mission, but not an end to the U.S. troop presence or an end to the U.S. partnership with Iraq. So we probably won't see a big change in the number of U.S. troops there. As you mentioned, there are 2,500 U.S. troops right currently in Iraq.
Well, some might be saying now that advisory role can sometimes be a slippery slope. You know, you remember mm-hmm. Vietnam. But what does the Iraq government, gain from this announcement?
Well, the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi is under a lot of pressure at home to get U.S. troops out, especially after the U.S. assassinated a top Iranian general along with an Iraqi militia leader in January of 2020. Since then, you know, Iranian-backed militias and political parties have all been pushing to get U.S. troops out. But the prime minister is trying to strike this balance because ISIS does remain a threat. He needs U.S. support with intelligence sharing and training. He's trying to keep on good terms with both the U.S. and Iran and keep Iraq from becoming this sort of proxy battle zone. And that's a tough task, Robin, because, you know, the Iranian-backed militias often fire rockets at U.S. bases, and that remains a threat for the U.S.
Yeah. Well, and we know the U.S. tried this withdrawal from Iraq before 2011. Then U.S. forces went back after the rise of ISIS in 2014. So what kind of power does the Islamic State hold now?
It no longer controls any ground. You know, when the U.S. went back in 2014, ISIS controlled Mosul, so that's no longer the case. But the group does remain a threat. It recently claimed responsibility for a deadly market attack in Baghdad. There are also still remnants of ISIS in Syria, and U.S. troops based in Iraq have been supporting that fight against ISIS in Syria, too. So that's going to be something to continue to watch.
And just briefly, under a minute here, but as we said, Afghanistan is a complete troop withdrawal, even though the Taliban is on the rise there. So why is this proposed exit different in Iraq?
Well, you know, when it comes to Afghanistan, Biden has long had doubts about what the U.S. could accomplish there. He didn't support President Obama's decision to surge troops in Afghanistan. So that's sort of his history. He does seem to view Iraq differently as a more important country in the Middle East, at least strategically. The U.S. wants to see Iraq rebuild ties with Arab states, and the U.S. wants a stable partner in Iraq, which borders both Syria and Iran.
Yeah. NPR's diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's the number of colleges and universities, including the entire Ivy League, that now say they'll require one or two doses of coronavirus vaccine for students and staff this fall. But there are plenty, large and small, public and private, that are not having that requirement. There are also states passing laws against school vaccine mandates, and there are lawsuits from students who say mandates violate their rights. The most prominent was settled a week ago after a judge ruled that Indiana University, a state school, is within its right to require students to be vaccinated and also to require testing and masking. That decision is considered precedent-setting and was based on the judge's ruling that the mandate does not infringe on the students' constitutional rights. But will his ruling stand? Let's bring in Professor Dorit Rice from the UC Hastings School of Law in California. She focuses on legal and policy issues related to vaccines. So, Professor Rice, welcome back, and you've probably been quite busy.
Thank you. It's an interesting time.
Yes. Let's get to what U.S. District Court Judge Damon Lady said about the student's claim. Essentially, they said the vaccine requirement violated their due process under the 14th Amendment. What exactly do they mean, and what does it mean that the judge turned it back?
So the 14th Amendment protects against interference in life, liberty, and property without due process of law. There's two meanings to that. One meaning is procedural. It means you can't be arrested or otherwise have your liberty infringed without some procedures. The other is substantive. The government can't violate your rights without a good enough reason. What's a good enough reason depends on how strong your right is being violated. The judge said first, the right to go to college unvaccinated is a liberty protected, but it has a regular level of protection, not a super strong one. And second, the judge said, within that regular level of protection, a university or a state can limit your liberty in the name of public health as long as the limit is reasonable. And he found this limit to be reasonable.
Well, and that's what we tend to think about schools. In recent history, children have to show that they have a vaccination to go to schools. But how is their claim to infringement of their rights any different from saying you can't drive a car without wearing your seatbelt?
So you're right that there is a lot of similarity here. We regulate the conduct of people all the time to protect others. But most of those regulations can be challenged, and most of them will stand because they're reasonable. If the state decides you can't drive a car unless you paint your nose blue and dance the polka before you get in the car, that may be challenged as an unreasonable interference in liberty because that has nothing to do with driving safely. The students are making a similar claim, and they were also trying to up the ante by claiming that their rights here deserve higher protection. They were trying to say the right is a fundamental right, the right to personal bodily autonomy that deserves extra protection, and the university can only limit our attendance if they meet a much higher bar. The judge rejected that and said, no, this is not a fundamental right. It's a regular right, and all we need to show is that it's reasonable.
Yeah. Well, the judge also said that Indiana University developed its vaccine policy after extensive research. A committee of more than a dozen people, seven doctors, expertise, the judge said, in public health, epidemiology, virology, data modeling. Why does that matter so much?
So looking at the fact that the university went through a careful, thorough process, got advice from experts, thought it through, supports the conclusion that the university's decision was reasonable.
Well, of the 8 students in the lawsuit, 6 already had religious exemptions. They also objected to testing and masking. One said vegans are less likely to get sick. Another claimed nasal swabs cause cancer. Did the judge address this misinformation?
Not directly. The judge pointed out that these are long-standing requirements the university used and said it's perfectly reasonable to apply these requirements to people who are exempt from the vaccines.
Look, that's Indiana. It's being closely watched. What impact do you think it's going to have? Because in other states, let's say you move over to Arizona, there it's not student lawsuits. It's the governor issuing an executive order blocking vaccine mandates on campuses. Can you do that?
Yes. So public universities are a creature of the state, and the state can regulate them. And to what degree is going to depend on the state specifics, but most of the time, the state can limit the ability of universities to adopt this kind of policy. And some have gone pretty far. They also limited the ability of universities to require masking, kind of setting up those universities for future outbreaks.
Most who follow the science believe that, but you talk about public schools, but in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, back in May, signed into law a ban on vaccine mandates at both public and private colleges and universities. So maybe that law will be tested too. How can you mandate what a private school requires? But could you take up another thing that anti-vaccine people are saying? It's complete misinformation. But they are saying that because this is emergency use authorization for all of these vaccines, it's asking somebody to do something that has not been proven. You know, we've already spoken a great deal in this program about how that's not what emergency use authorization means. Your thoughts on that claim? You can't coerce somebody to do something that's not approved or licensed.
Good. So there's 2 parts to the argument that you cannot require a vaccine under an EUA. One is, as you so nicely set out, that vaccines under an EUA are experimental and untested, and therefore it's unethical to mandate. That's not a very good claim for these vaccines, because they have been through tens of thousands of participants in clinical trial. They've been given to many millions with very strong safety and effectiveness data. So the claim that they're untested is not very good. But there is a technical legal claim based on the Emergency Use Authorization Act that is a little stronger. And that claim is, the Emergency Use Authorization Act tells the Secretary of Health to tell people that they can accept or refuse the vaccine. And some interpret that to mean if you can accept or refuse the vaccine, there can't be mandates. Others point out that the act doesn't say anything to employers or universities or states, just to the secretary. And since we have a history of mandates at the state level, at the university level, at the employer, reading into that silence, a complete prohibition on mandating vaccine, is reading a lot into it. We have 1 court decision on this, and that court decision said the law doesn't speak to private employers at all. That's a Texas case against Methodist Hospital.
What about the danger of schools not requiring vaccines? Are they at legal risk if there's an outbreak?
First of all, if the governor says you can't do it, it's going to be really hard to sue a university for not mandating a vaccine, because the governor prohibited it. Without that prohibition, some schools may face a risk of being sued if there's an outbreak, if they didn't do anything to prevent it or didn't do much to prevent it. In other states, without that prohibition, if the school doesn't do enough and there's an outbreak, there may be lawsuits.
By the way, Indiana University said it will only require students to fill out a self-attestation form, attesting, you know, that they've been vaccinated.
Yes. So what happened there was, Indiana has a law that prohibits government from requiring evidence of a vaccine status. This was actually in place before this lawsuit. So the university is not allowed to require documented proof of the status, but it is allowed to mandate it without requiring such proofs. In theory, students who lie on it can face all kinds of penalties. It is illegal to commit fraud against the government, but because of Indiana's law that prohibits requiring documentation of vaccine status, they can't require documents. This kind of law makes it a lot trickier for universities, assuming they really want to make their campus safer.
Boy, it gets complicated fast. That's Dorit Rice, professor of law specializing in vaccine legality and policy at UC Hastings in California. Professor Rice, thank you.
Thank you.
And now, a quick update on a man determined to run from Florida to New York by way of Bermuda on water in a giant inflatable hamster wheel he calls a hydropod. It did not go well. 49-year-old ultramarathoner Reza Belushi has washed ashore near Hammock, Florida, just 30 miles from his starting point, about 970 miles short of his goal. Flagler County authorities reportedly arrived at the scene after frightened 911 callers reported seeing a UFO. Belushi's heart is in the right place, he told a Florida TV station. He wanted to show people that anything you want to do, do it. Don't listen to anyone. Chase your dreams. He called his journey Chasing the Dream. It was a fundraiser for first responders, including the Coast Guard, who were involved in his rescue, as well as a prior one in 2014, at a cost of about $144,000.
Fans of the late Anthony Bourdain rushed to see a new documentary about his life when it was released earlier this month. Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, was for many an opportunity to connect one more time with the globetrotting chef and author who took his own life in 2018.
I said earlier that I was going to tell you the truth. This is part of it.
But one small part of that movie has sparked a big debate. The director used an artificially generated version of Bourdain's voice to recreate one of his emails. For more details, we're joined by Karen Howe. She's an editor at the MIT Technology Review. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Celeste.
How did they use this AI voice in the film?
Bourdain had this email that the director really wanted to be read aloud in the film, and there was no audio of that email, so they took all of the existing audio they had of Anthony Bourdain's voice, fed it into an AI algorithm, and that algorithm was able to then create a synthetic version of Bourdain's voice that sounded basically like him and read the email as though it were him.
And part of the controversy is generated, as I understand, by the fact that they did it so well that it sounded
right,
like Anthony Bourdain.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you didn't know that it was generated, you wouldn't hear the audio and automatically assume that it was done by an AI and not by Bourdain himself. So there's sort of two issues that made it controversial. One was this disclosure aspect. The director didn't actually disclose the audio either by making it audibly obvious that it was replicated and didn't disclose it in another way by just explicitly telling the audience. But the other issue that people kind of grated against was this idea of consent. Obviously, this was done after Bourdain has passed away, and he never had an opportunity to agree to having his voice and his email represented in this way. And so I think the audience and many fans of him were just really uncomfortable.
This is not the first time that AI-generated either images or voices have made people feel uncomfortable. Where do we stand in terms of figuring out what's right and what's wrong about the ethical line between recreating either the image or voice of a celebrity?
This is such new technology, and it's just become professionalized to the degree where we can use it in productions like documentaries now. So there really are no standards and norms around this. We certainly have had examples of success stories. There was an example of a documentary from 2020 called Welcome to Chechnya, where the director decided to use deepfake faces to conceal the identities of people that he needed to protect in the film. And in that particular instance, he made some ethical calls that went well, and the audience agreed with those decisions and resonated with the way that he approached it. Obviously, in this particular instance with Roadrunner, the audience did not. And so right now, we're really in this phase of trial and error where a lot of creators and directors are kind of just experimenting and then effectively figuring out through call and response what people think is appropriate.
I mean, there was also an example of a film in which they used AI to create Richard Nixon's voice to read a speech that he would have given if the mission to the moon had been unsuccessful.
Yes, so this is a really interesting creative endeavor where these two MIT researchers wanted to see what it would be like to do revisionist history with deepfakes. So they created both a visual deepfake of Nixon and an audio deepfake of his voice reading this speech that he would have delivered that was actually written but was never delivered. And in that particular instance, they packaged the project in a way that very clearly labeled that this is a deep fake, that it was an artistic experiment, and it was meant to just see what kind of emotions this kind of technology could evoke. And the effect is amazing. The first time I watched it, I definitely got shivers.
What are your concerns, though? I mean, I have to be honest, knowing that people could create not just my voice convincingly, but my image saying things I never said convincingly is unnerving. What worries you about this?
It is very unnerving. I mean, we have already seen outside of the professionalized entertainment or journalism industry, these types of technologies really wreaking havoc in ways that the inventors never really thought about. A lot of the conversation is obviously around political deepfakes and the fear that we might be able to recreate a politician saying something that they never said or doing something they never did. But there's also been vast consequences for women when it comes to things like revenge porn. It is really concerning in that if we don't have a good handle of this technology as a society, meaning both people who are using it think about it ethically and regulators who are trying to control it think about it comprehensively, it could really damage our understanding of media and our trust in media.
And reality, what happened or didn't. Karen Howe is an editor at the MIT Technology Review. Karen, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.